Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the food and wine of Sicily reflect the values, lifestyles, and culture of its people? Although the island is less than 2 miles from the boot tip of Italy, that distance has been enough to preserve the unique character and slow pace stolen from parts of the Italian mainland by the encroachment of the modern world. And to my guest, it is a magical place, emerging for the first time in its history from the constraints initially of foreign domination and later of the insidious influence of the mafia. Robert V. Camuto is a journalist and travel writer. He founded the Fort Worth Weekly in 1996, then sold it in 2000 to move to France, where he lives with his family in a remodeled olive oil mill. His new book is called Palmento, A Sicilian Wine Odyssey. He's in town to sign copies tonight at Jimmy's Food Store in Dallas. That event takes place between 5:30 and 6:30. Robert, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Great to be here.
So your grandfather was born in Sicily, but you say that's not really the whole reason that you are just so drawn to the place.
No. I mean, I love Italy. I live in France, about 50 minutes from the Italian border. And I love traveling through both France and Italy. My first book was about France and its terroir. And I, through that first book, became just passionate about traveling through these terroir, finding authenticity in these villages, and seeing this movement towards a more artisanal way of doing things. Perhaps those are things that had been lost for a generation or two, and now we see younger generations returning to the land, returning to some basic values, if you will. And I saw my trip to Sicily as a sort of a continuation of that because, as you so eloquently said in the introduction, Sicily has kind of remained unchanged, while the mainland in many aspects has changed, become more modern, tasteful, cosmopolitan, etc. And I like to think of Sicily as sort of the Galapagos Islands of Italy, that being an island, it has been separated. And I say the Galapagos because as the world changed around it, people still found Darwin found these magical birds and creatures and natural life there.
So what does authenticity mean when it comes to winemaking? What does it mean to the people who are actually doing it?
Well, I think when you talk about authenticity in general, culturally, food, wine, et cetera, in general, authenticity to me means a place that hasn't been Epcotized.
Right.
And I would say, for example, there's a tremendous amount of tourism in Tuscany, but I think that Tuscany has lost a lot of its originality. And some of that has to do with real estate,
it's expensive,
real estate speculation, mm-hmm. prices going up. And I think in those situations, when you have a booming real estate market, it suddenly doesn't become very profitable or reasonable to work the land anymore.
So how is the history of Sicily different from the history of Italy in terms of who was in charge and sort of how things happen day to day?
Well, I think the thing you have to understand, too, is that so often from this side of the Atlantic, we think of these countries as entire countries. We think of France as France, Italy as Italy. But really, Italy is just a collection of regions. Italy just had its 150th birthday and as a united country. But before that time, Italy really was a series of kingdoms and dukedoms. I mean, you had the Piemontese, the Tuscans, the Venetians, the Neapolitans, the Sicilians, the Calabrians. And all these regions were in just various combinations for centuries and centuries and centuries. And the idea of an Italian language as we know it was really only created after unification for the military so that people could speak to each other because a Sicilian wouldn't understand someone from the Piedmont or Neapolitan. And there's one story that I have in the book of a gentleman aristocrat in Sicily whose family had come to Sicily by way of northern Europe, but who was talking about how when his grandfather went to northern Italy, he had to go even to a pharmacy. He had to speak in Latin to be understood.
Huh. So you decided to go there. It doesn't sound like a midlife crisis. It sounds like a really elegant midlife decision. But talk about what made you decide to spend this year in Sicily.
Well, this particular year, it was a big birthday of mine. It was my 50th birthday. And I said, well, if I have one more year to spend, how would I spend it? And I spent more than a year there, not continually. I would travel there every month. Mm-hmm. And I continue to go to Sicily. I'm going next month. And traveling there has, I would say, been a life-transforming experience. And I would say, if I had to say the single way that it's been transforming is from the Sicilian people, I feel that I've learned really to live more from the heart, so to speak.
Is it immediately apparent to them that you're American? I mean, you speak Italian. You look like you could have been born in Sicily yourself. Does that help you get around the fact that you can blend in, or do you feel very much like an American when you're there?
I feel very much at home in Sicily. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, they're the most welcoming people in the world, and I think it depends how you are. And I think that if you interact with people, if you speak a bit of Italian, that people accept you for who you are.
And when you would ask to tour places where people were making wine, it wouldn't be just 45 minutes of walking around. It would be, am I right, days and days of sort of explanations about how everything works?
Well, this is what I like to say. When I worked on my first book, Corkscrewed, about France, an initial appointment with a winemaker might last 2 hours. And in Sicily, some of those initial appointments might last 2 days. And after the first day, I would be asking myself, I would look at my notes, I would have none.
And what am I doing?
I would say, what have I accomplished here? And all we'd really done was eat, drink, and live life with these fascinating characters.
You have throughout the book some remarkable descriptions of great meals and great wines. Are you, in fact, making notes as you go along in your travels so you'll remember how something felt in your mouth or what it tasted like or what the air smelled like?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Yes, of course I do that. Yes. And there's so many sensations and smells and tastes and on a journey like that. It can be almost disorienting at times.
Talk about your time. Continue. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, like in the cuisine, there's really about four or five Sicilian cuisines, and a lot of it is very much Arab influenced, salty, sweet, sour combinations of things that we don't really have not traditionally experienced in the United States. And one reason is that a lot of the traditional cooking, when it travel to the U.S., where incidentally there are more Sicilian Americans than there are Sicilians in Sicily, a lot of those things got lost for many reasons. One of which, I heard a recent explanation that was very interesting, was that when the Sicilians came, then the Neapolitans already controlled the grocery stores, so the ingredients were a little different. Huh. And by the way, one thing I wanted to mention in these varied cuisines, they're all tied to the land and what grows there. And for example, in Ragusa in southeast Sicily, you find more almond-influenced cuisine. When they make pesto, it's with almonds. Around Etna, it's with pistachios. In the southwest of Sicily, you find a lot of couscous, obviously an Arab influence. And it's now believed that pasta made its way to the mainland Italian peninsula through from North Africa through Sicily.
How much do people on the island of Sicily sort of travel around? I mean, obviously now they've got cars and roads and they can travel easily, but is there a great deal of sort of regional influence in the places where they come together?
Yes. I mean, I think the society is mobile and modern, but you still meet people who have never left their village. Hmm. But a lot of the Sicilian winemakers are obviously now well-traveled. Their wines are exported. They go to they come to the United States or to mainland Europe or Japan.
Talk a little bit about the history of the acceptance and the desire for Sicilian wines. It's, I guess, been a sort of a checkered past over time.
Yes. Well, wine has been made in Sicily for thousands of years, of course. The first settlers were the Greeks, followed by the Romans, Byzantines, Arabs, Normans, etc. The heyday, oh, and it is currently Italy's largest wine-producing region in terms of volume. The heyday of Sicilian winemaking was about the time of the, was really the 19th century for several reasons. The Marsala trade had been developed by the English. Marsala is a fortified sherry, fine sherry-like wine. And also as the phylloxera blight swept across Europe, Spain, Italy, France, those countries turned to Sicily, which was very late to get phylloxera for their production. So ports were built, oenology schools were built, and there was a lot of wine flowing out of Sicily for that time. That still continues to this day, where wine is shipped out to to fortify wines in other European countries. It's sort of not something that's very much talked about, but it still exists to some extent. What happened in the 20th century was not a very good time for a Sicilian wine, particularly after World War II. You had the bottom fall out of the Marsala market. After the war, Italians were not drinking Marsala. They were drinking more modern aperitifs like Coca-Cola or whiskey. And at the same time, you had a push towards industrialization, and the emphasis was on producing greater and greater quantities, meaning that they left the higher hillsides for the flatter plains that were more tractor-friendly. And that produced great quantities of wine that wasn't very good. There has been a renaissance in Sicily, as in many, many regions of Europe. If you think about it, in 1980, how many great Italian wines were there? There were very few. And I remember growing up in an Italian-American family, there was always the ever-present fiasco of Chianti. And
and the little basket weave jug.
Yes, yes. And in the last 10, 15 years, you've seen a new generation returning to the practices that maybe had been lost and returning to some of these older, more difficult-to-work vineyards to produce quality wine. There are so many factors involved in that because Sicilians themselves never really drink, have not traditionally drunk wine out of bottles. The wine was always family production, so to speak, and people have a natural mistrust for anything that might come in a bottle. They would say, oh, well, it's watered down, or they add chemicals, or there's got to be something wrong with it. But I think today there is a wine culture, and it's a very exciting one. 20 years ago, there were about 30 wine producers putting wine in bottles, and now there's about 300. So it's something that's really growing. And aside from that, it's very interesting because these people are going back into the vineyards and discovering what they have there.
My guest this hour is journalist and travel writer Robert V. Camuto. His new book is called Palmento, A Sicilian Wine Odyssey. He's in town for a book signing this evening at 5:30, between 5:30 and 6:30 at Jimmy's Food Store in Dallas. You can find information at robertcamuto.net. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and travel writer Robert V. Camuto. His new book is called Palmetto, A Sicilian Wine Odyssey. He's in town to sign books this evening between 5:30 and 6:30 at Jimmy's Food Store in Dallas. You can find information at robertcamuto.net. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk a little bit about the mafia, because people who know nothing else about Sicily know that there is this long association. It's starting to change, but sort of slowly and fitfully. Can you talk about that?
Yes. One of the things I like to talk about also is the fact that I believe that now the generations of Sicilians at this point are experiencing freedom for the first time. Mm-hmm. And when I say freedom, what I mean is people's ability to live life and pursue their goals as they would in a sort of reasonable way. And up until 1830, Sicily was feudal. You had these vast land holdings called latifundi. And after that point, land form was voted and due to happen. And yet, because of famine, because of different problems throughout the 19th century, that never occurred. So meaning that change never really occurred till after World War II. And it was after World War II that the modern mafia, as we know it, took over. And they took over with people like Lucky Luciano, who was in a federal prison in New York but was released for his help with the U.S. in securing the ports of New York during World War II. And he was returned to Sicily. But when he and some of his associates returned to Sicily in southern Italy, they returned as a sort of untouchable class. Mm-hmm. And they brought back some of the techniques that they, let's say, perfected in America to Sicily. And then you had drug wars, and you had terrible mafia wars in the take place in the 60s and 70s. And it really became an all-pervasive thing. I mean, Sicily in the 70s, some people have described it almost like Afghanistan. It was terrible. And it wasn't until 1992, with the assassination of the two very popular federal prosecutors, Falcone and Borsellino, that the Sicilian people, and really women, rose up to say, we've had enough. This is it, and basically did force change in Sicily. The problem is that many of these criminals and mafia bosses, as we know them, are in prison today. But the politicians who collaborated with them, are many of them still remain in office. And so as Mario Puzo once said, I believe, it's easier to steal $1 million with one lawyer with a briefcase than it is with 200 men with machine guns. And so I think that that sort of official corruption exists not only in Sicily but throughout the Italian government to some extent.
What happens to the landholdings that were under the control of mafia bosses?
I have a chapter in my book on that. It's called Return to Corleone. And incidentally, what I find just amazing is that Corleone became the capital of the of mafia power after the Godfather movies came out. It's kind of one of those bizarre coincidences of life imitating art. But what's happening now is in the anti-mafia movement, so-called, there's a movement called Libera Terra. And what Libera Terra is, it's a system wherein and an organization wherein ex-mafia lands are transferred to sort of nonprofit groups mm-hmm. to use for nonprofit public good purposes. So you have ex-mafia vineyards where these nonprofit groups make wine, or you have ex-wheat mafia-owned wheat fields where that wheat is turned into Libera Terra pasta and so on and so on, with tomato sauce and other agricultural products.
Were any of the members of the mafia making decent wine?
Well, you know, I think that I've never tasted mafia wine. As far as I know. But I think that their main interest was, one of the things I explored in the book is, what was the mafia's connection to the land? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was really so much a love affair as it or a real love of the land as it was a way to show off.
So it was like a vanity project.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, to show their power.
Talk about Mount Etna.
Yes, Mount Etna, of course, is just a fascinating area of Sicily on the south northeastern point of the island above Catania, and it is just a legendary, amazing place. It's Europe's largest active volcano, clearly, and it's in an almost constant state of eruption. There's always some smoke coming out of it. Every once in a while, it'll throw off a bunch of lava, and you can see these rivers running down the side of it from afar. And it's perched there right above the Ionian Sea, right above Catania. And there are all sorts of myths and legends associated with it, going back to the idea that the Greeks believed Vulcan lived there. But aside from that, as far as the winemaking goes and as far as the agriculture, it's divided up into very small, difficult-to-work parcels. It's a soil that is obviously volcanic, sand. It's a place where the devastating phylloxera blight, in many cases, never touched, because phylloxera doesn't live in sandy soils, and also because the sulfur in the air would be a cure for that. And Etna now is just a place where you have winemakers, foreign winemakers from all over the world, even Tuscany and other parts of Italy, going to grow wine there, to make wine there. And it's just a very, very exciting scene. They make red wines there. They make white wines there. And I think one of the reasons for the interest is the fact that you can grow wine at altitude there. I think in southern climes, it's very, very important to have some kind of altitude in order to have wines with some kind of finesse and length and elegance to them. Otherwise, you end up with wines that are very cooked and jammy. And so it's a difficult place to make wine, but the results can be phenomenal.
I was surprised there's as much white wine made in Sicily as there is.
Yes, well, Sicily, in fact, would have more white grapes planted than red grapes, in fact. And the whole western part of the island is really dominated by white wines. Many varietals like Cattarato, Gracanico, and Zolia that were used to make Marsala. Now, with Marsala less in demand after the war, as I was saying, it became kind of more of a cheap cooking wine that was found in grocery shelves alongside vinegar. Now you see producers experimenting with those varietals to make dry white wines.
And when you talk about younger people coming in, are they coming back to something that their ancestors did? You open the book with the story of a trio, I guess, of winemakers. Can you tell us a little bit about them and sort of how they got started? And they're not so young now, but they got started as very young men.
Well, I think it's a fairly typical story of Sicily and Europe in general. And that trio of winemakers, they were all students in Palermo. Two of them were architectural students, and the third, I believe, was a medical student. And one of these young men, Tita is his name, his father had these lands around Vittoria and had been a wine grower, a contadino, a peasant. And he saw he and his college friends come back for the summer, and he said, oh, these college boys, you know, you need something to do for the summer. You need to work. So the first year he gave them a ton of grapes, and he said, do something with this. And so they did. The second year he gave them 2 tons of grapes, and every year he doubled that. And it was something that they fell into while they were doing their studies and found that they could, when they went back to school, that they could sell this wine in Palermo. And that's how they got started in that. But I think that oftentimes what you see are, and not just in Sicily, but throughout Europe and France also, families after the war brought a lot of their, all their grapes to cooperatives. And when you do that in a cooperative, you're just throwing it in with everybody else. You're making a product, or you're contributing to a product that you really have no say over, and that doesn't have much character. It's thrown into the vat. They make whatever wine they're going to make with it. And now I think you see people are drinking less wine, but they're drinking better. So I think the world is interested in different wines, diversity, different tastes, different flavors, not just having rivers of the same old jug wine. And so I think you see new generations of saying, well, you know, I could take Grandpa's vineyard and do something unique with it and make my sort of wine, my sort of statement that reflects this land.
The thing that still doesn't really exist in Sicily is these big sort of tours that bring people from winery to winery and you get off the bus. Is that a good thing, do you think, that it's not a place for wine tourism yet?
Well, I think there is a certain amount of wine tourism, but I think if you're talking about the Napa-style tourism, that doesn't exist. There's mm-hmm. not gift shops with ball caps and this and that. And it's on a much more personal basis. Mm-hmm. And of course, I like that because when you talk about that mass wine tourism, your chances of actually meeting the people who are producing the wine or growing the grapes is more limited. You're more there with a tour guide who might have studied marketing and is not...
Got 38 minutes to get the next group
right,
through.
Right, exactly.
And what does it take to sort of ask someone to show you around? And do you have to sort of schedule time ahead of time? Do they know that you're a writer? Or if you had just been yourself and you'd come to visit, would they have made time for you?
I think that... I think in many cases a call ahead is good, but when you're in the wine country in Sicily, I think you can just start talking to people at a local restaurant or cafe. If you find a bottle of wine that you like, you can follow that bottle to the people who produced it. And in many cases, the Sicilians are just so, so hospitable that, you know, before you know it, you'll be meeting their kids, their dog, their donkey, and even their, you know, their cousins.
Talk about some of the traditional techniques. We should mention that your title, Palmento, refers to like a little stone building in which a wine press would be located. Is that right?
Yes. The Palmento is a system that dates back. Pliny the Elder wrote about the system that you find in the traditional Sicilian Palmenti. And it's a very interesting system because it's all gravity fed, very environmental, in the sense that the grapes would come in at the higher level on a hillside, for example. They would be stomped, the juice would flow down into this vat, and all the skins would go in there. And after about 2 days of fermentation, the wine would still be in full fermentation. They would pull the plug, it would go into the lower vat, from which they would put it in barrels and take it down the hillside. They would also take all the remaining skins, wrap those in rope, and there would be a big torque press that they would lower onto that to squeeze the juice out of. And these palmenti were all over the vineyards in the sense that They were very local. It would go vineyard by vineyard because so much of the work of transporting grapes was done on people's backs, on donkeys. They didn't have trucks to bring them to a central winery.
Yeah.
So these places, to me, they're extremely beautiful and evocative. As one of the winemaker architects says in the book, he said that he was talking about One Palmetto, and he's an architect himself, and he said, this place is perfect. It wasn't designed by an architect. It was designed by the kind of necessities of traditional winemaking. And those old Palmenti that you see, for example, on Mount Etna that are all made in lava stone, it's illegal to make wine there now under current EU sanitary regulations. But people still do for their personal stock. That's legal. And there's also a few winemakers who do make some limited production commercial wines for in Palmentos, in Palmenti. But being that it's Sicily, the law is sometimes more of a suggestion than it is something that's firm. It's a little don't ask, don't tell.
It sounds like driving law is the same way.
Yes, yes. One of the first things I found when I arrived in Sicily that time is it was shocking the number of people that don't wear seatbelts, and also the way road markings are kind of mere suggestions. I find that in a Sicilian traffic jam, if there's three lanes of traffic, the Sicilians will immediately make four.
My guest this hour is journalist and travel writer Robert V. Camuto. He founded the Fort Worth Weekly in 1996, now lives in France. His new book is called Palmetto, A Sicilian Wine Odyssey. He's in town for a book signing this evening from 5:30 to 6:30 at Jimmy's Food Store in Dallas. You can find details on the Think page of KERA.org or at robertcamuto.net. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert V. Camuto, author of the new book Palmetto, A Sicilian Wine Odyssey. He's in town for a book signing event this evening at 5:30 at Jimmy's Food Store in Dallas. If you'd like information on that, you can go to robertcamuto.net or the Think page of KERA.org. Join us on the phones at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Mickey in Addison asks if you can talk about the hilltop towns like Enna and the fabulous mosaics at the Piazza Armerina.
Yes. Well, you know, as far as art and history, I mean, Sicily just abounds with that. The mosaics in Piazza Armerina are just one of the many treasures that are in Sicily. You know, there is more Greek ruins, for example, in the southern part of Sicily than there are in many parts of Greece. The Baroque towns of eastern Sicily, which was completely rebuilt in the late Baroque period after a devastating earthquake, is another great treasure. So I would just say that for any lovers of art and art history, I mean, Sicily is just essential. And there are so many, every village almost in certain areas just has more and more history to uncover.
There are places where the wine is stored in terracotta rather than in wooden barrels. Can you talk about how that affects the character of the wine?
Well, for example, in one of the chapters of my book, I talk about a winery by the name of Kos, which is in Vittoria, and they are currently the largest producers in Italy of wine in amphora, clay amphora. And it's an idea that's very interesting because certainly wine would have been made in clay amphora since Greek times, and certainly the Romans, that's how they transported liquids. And for one thing, it's beautiful to see when mm-hmm. you go into a winery with all these clay amphora sunken in sand.
Yeah, sort of buried down.
Yes, yes. As far as what that does to the taste, wine nowadays is traditionally fermented in either stainless steel, cement, in some cases large barrels. I think wine made in clay becomes a little bit more living because it gets more oxygen, and the quality over time can be variable. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes in modern winemaking, when these big wine producers make wine, they want a product that almost from year to year, from bottle to bottle, from case to case, you're going to get the same thing. Mm-hmm. This is definitely not the case with wine made in amphoras. And what I find that's interesting is if I have 6 or 12 bottles in my cellar, I can go open one month, and I go, oh, this is awful. This is not at all what I remember. And then 2 months later, I'll say, wow, this is fabulous. And so wine is really a living thing. There are so many chemical reactions that go into it. And in wine country, not only in Sicily but throughout Europe, I mean, people will talk about how the harvest time is always a bad time to open bottles because the wine somehow senses that it's the harvest time. And it tends to change during that period or get a little nervous, so to speak.
How do people in Italy, in Sicily rather, use wine? At what occasions do they drink and sort of what do they decide to drink with what foods? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think in general in Sicily and throughout the Mediterranean, wine is always present. I mean, wine is a part of life. It's something that is always there. It's something that's always shared. Obviously, in the more coastal areas, you have white wine because the diet is almost all seafood. Mm-hmm. With some of your other foods, meat dishes, etc., you have red wines. Sicily also produces a fantastic amount of, some fantastic sweet wines made from Malvasia, Moscato, on the island of Pantelleria. There's the Passito di Pantelleria, which is made from grapes that lie out in the sun to concentrate their flavors. That's another beautiful sweet wine. So I think that in the course of one meal, you know, perhaps if it's an important meal on Sunday or for a holiday, people might drink 2 to 3 kinds of wine, white to red to a sweet wine.
So I want to talk a little bit about your life when you are not writing, because it sounds like the most romantic thing in the world. So in 2000, you move to France. You build out this old olive oil mill. You grow olives. You grow grapes. You make wine. You make oil. Is that as glamorous and delightful as it sounds every day, or is it a lot more work than people realize?
Well, I would say at the harvest time, it's a fair amount of work, but if you're doing it with friends and family, it's always fun. Mm-hmm. And physically, it can be a certain amount of work collecting olives. And there might be days when you're just absolutely beat tired. But at the end of the day, you have an enormous appetite, and to enjoy a meal with the friends and family who've been helping out is just fantastic.
What do you have to do to cure olives? Because you can't eat one raw. Is that right?
That's true. In general, what happens to most olives is if you're making oil, you take those to a press. Mm-hmm. And from which the oil is extracted. As far as curing olives, there are several recipes. I like to, with black olives that get to their full black maturity, I like to add sea salt in a bowl and just turn those every day. And there's this dark liquid that comes off. Mm-hmm. And out of that comes all the bitterness. And that takes a couple of weeks of curing to do. You can also put them in a brine solution, and that takes several months.
And you make wine as well from your grapes?
I make wine with a partner, another American who lives in my village mm-hmm. in France. And we've done it for 5 years now. And we've planted our vines. They're very young. And we add our grapes to the grapes that we pick from a friend's about an hour away. And what's very interesting about that is I wanted to start making wine because here I write about it a certain amount. And I wanted to kind of have a feel for what goes into making wine, to really experience that. Because a lot of people might write about wine and talk about wine, but really don't know, have not really experienced what goes into making wine.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like advising people on child rearing without ever having done it themselves.
They're always better at it before they have their own kids.
Exactly. And I remember when we brought our first big batch of grapes home, shoved in the back of the station wagon, we brought these grapes home, and I did kind of feel like a new parent taking your child home from the hospital. What do we do now? Where's the manual? You know, we have to take its temperature. We have to do all this stuff. But I think with time, we've become better winemakers by interfering a little bit less. The first year, for example, we added yeast because we felt, it had to do that to ferment. But after that first year, we didn't even add yeast. The wine took off by itself, and I think it's better for it.
Do you have an emotional understanding of winemakers that you think you wouldn't have had if you hadn't made your own?
I think so. I think experiencing some of the difficulties and decisions that winemakers have to make is something that I learned. Because really, winemaking is a lot of little decisions. It's a lot of spontaneous reaction to, ooh, why is the wine doing this? What's happening here? I mean, there's so many chemical reactions that go into it and so many little surprises that you can't help but identify more, empathize more when you've been through that process.
Is it hard to step back and wait for the time it takes to be ready?
Well, yes. Yes, I mean, there's obviously a inclination to want things to finish really quickly, but you know, in basic red wine making, there's two steps of fermentation. There's a primary fermentation, and there's a secondary or malolactic fermentation that converts the lactic acid to malic acid to lactic acid, which gives it a much more smoother, milky, more palatable quality. And sometimes waiting on that, we've had one occasion where our 2010 vintage finished before the 2009 vintage.
Just based on the properties of the
different grapes. Yeah, so you have to be very adjustable. And we only have so many containers to put all this stuff in. I mean, we're only making 100 bottles, so it gets tricky.
I wonder if it's a little bit like, you know, I've heard it described that writer's block is about being so hung up on writing the very best thing that's ever been put on paper that you just can't get the words down. Is starting to make wine the same way? You have to just go into it and learn as you go and not be so hung up on it being perfect the first time?
I'd say that's true. Yes. Or I think you have to resist the idea that you have to be doing something, that you have to be controlling the wine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think really what winemaking is more about is just kind of protecting the wine and letting it do its thing and protecting it. You're protecting it mainly from air. I mean, you just can't leave it out because
right.
then it'll turn to vinegar. So I think what you're mainly doing is being a good housekeeper, cleaning up
mm-hmm.
and protecting it.
So for people who now are dying to go to Sicily, do you have any sort of recommendations for the first timer?
For the first timer, I would say don't try to see it all
mm-hmm.
because Sicilians like to say they're not an island, they're a continent. And I think it's true. And the driving distances can be very long. The island, there are essentially two airports, two halves of the island. There's Palermo in the northwest and Catania in the east. And I would just say don't try to do too much. It's good to have a little bit of a Sicilian pace to stay in one part of the island and get local, so to speak. And then after that, there's the off islands that are absolutely fantastic, the Lipari Islands, and you can take boat trips. And so for people who like being on water, or people who like mountains also, and culture and history, there's just so, so much to do there.
And you're hoping there will never be a bridge between the Italian mainland and Sicily.
Of course, yes. I think that island cultures tend to be a little bit stronger. They have a little bit stronger sense of identity because of their isolation. I think that if Italy does build a bridge between Calabria and Sicily, it would be terrible. I think it would be all over. I think that not to be too dramatic about it, but it is an interesting subject. It was Julius Caesar who first had the idea of building a bridge between Sicily and the toe of the Italian boot. And the bridge at that time was thought to be, the idea was that they would build this thing on barrels that would go through the water.
It's kind of an interesting proposition, actually.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, now it's Silvio Berlusconi, the embattled prime minister who wants to build the world's longest expansion bridge there. And we can only hope it doesn't happen.
Well, he's got a lot on his plate these days. So
yes.
Maybe he won't get around to finishing that one. Robert V. Camuto is a journalist and travel writer. His newest book is called Palmento, A Sicilian Wine Odyssey. He's in town for a book signing event that takes place tonight between 5:30 and 6:30 at Jimmy's Food Store in Dallas. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.